When I was making this body of work, I went for a walk. It was a very still morning. You can even hear wind. And all of a sudden, there was this crow that just leaped off of a boulder and took off into the sky. And it was such a piercing sound, or like a ripple in water. And I think that moments like that really inspire me. And the longer I live out in a place like the desert, I'm more attuned to listening to those things and I'm more sensitive to it.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is the painter Heather Day. Welcome, Heather.
Hi, thank you.
Heather, tell me, how did you come into art? When did contemporary art, making art, became a possibility in your life?
Well, I guess it depends on how far back we want to go, but I started painting and drawing when I was very little. I am severely dyslexic, and so I found painting, before I even knew what dyslexia was, I found it to be a wonderful outlet for me. Living in such a kind of concrete world with strict rules, I found painting to be a place for me to escape to and where I could create my own rules and boundaries.
Dyslexia means focus, concentration issues, or?
No, it means, well, it could cause that, but it means that I personally get disoriented very easily, and it's also a language issue. So I flip letters and words around on a page, or, yeah, trying to recall certain words.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's. I think I have that too. It's when you read a word and then you finish the word in your imagination, but not reading it till the end?
Yeah, I like kind of naturally just flip words.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. Which actually later on in life, it was a really great benefit with doing things like printmaking.
Yeah.
Because I naturally can flip an image or see a mirror image of something.
Because from printmaking, you develop your painting practice, which is sort of a collaging canvases?
I didn't discover printmaking until, I guess actually I did lithography in high school. I had this wonderful opportunity to go to an arts high school, and that was where I was really able to hone in on my studio practice from a young age. And that was where I actually discovered my love for abstraction. Mm-hmm. I remember I was living in Chicago, and I went to this the Art Institute of Chicago and saw Jackson Pollock painting for the first time. I believe it was called Autumn Rhythm. It's a painting from the early 1950s. And it was so interesting because I had studied it in art history and saw it in textbooks. And I just kind of glossed over abstraction and I didn't understand it. But I didn't know that on the side I was already kind of leaning heavily on abstraction with the brush marks. And I was more interested in capturing how something might feel versus mm-hmm. how it looks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when I saw this Jackson Pollock piece, I was just in awe with the way he could manipulate a medium and how he really went beyond paint. And it was about, I mean, Autumn Rhythm is kind of this gestural momentum with his body where it's like this repeating beat that happens in the painting.
Mm-hmm.
And once I experienced it in person, it mm-hmm. really had an impact on me. And that's when I later discovered a lot of the great female artists as I went to undergrad as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you had like a physical experience witnessing that painting.
I did. It was just, again, it broke all the rules of painting, which I was really drawn to, or the rules that I had developed academically learning to first paint with oil paint.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so gritty and gutsy and visceral. It was kind of everything that I wasn't in my personality just living out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really drawn to how painting and a studio practice could be everything that I'm not.
But it's interesting how, because you knew the work before and looked at it and spent time with it, so to speak, but not in person, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. The imagery just didn't do much for me looking at it in a textbook.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with Marcel Duchamp's Urinal, which is like one of the greatest pieces of modernism.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw it in person in the Moderna Musée and was a little, you know, I don't know, it didn't live up to my conceptual imagination.
Oh, it you was know, the opposite.
It was
for
the opposite,
you.
Yeah. Oh, the physical presence was like, it's more, you know, some works are just stronger in the head than, or in the mind than in reality. So, but because you were born in Honolulu?
I was.
Yeah. But then later on you moved to Chicago already to study art?
Yeah, it's a bit confusing, but I lived kind of a nomadic life as a child. My mom was a Marine, so I was born in Hawaii, and Hawaii is where my dad is from, born and raised.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly after that, we moved to Okinawa in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then I lived on the East Coast, kind of around Washington, D.C. area for a while. And I eventually moved to Chicago for high school, where I continued to find my love for painting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because when you look at your CV, it's like born in Honolulu, now living in California in, what's it called?
I live out in the high desert. It's a town called Joshua Tree.
Joshua Tree, exactly. Quite famous, no?
Yeah, it's known for the beautiful national park there.
Yeah. So, and that's interesting because somehow it usually I would say, where people are born and where they work and live is not saying so much about the practice, but somehow with your work, born in Hawaii, living in Joshua Tree, somehow it says something about the work, no? I would say.
Yeah, it sounds like a contradiction, but there's so much overlap to the desert and to a place like Hawaii. And I think there's moments when the storms roll in and you can see the rain clouds from a distance, and there's so much open space to think, and I think that the desert has a similar impact to standing on a cliff looking out at the ocean. It's just like this incredible vastness, and it has this ability to make you feel very small, and it's just a very humbling experience.
Yeah. So maybe to try to describe your practices, you work with canvases and painting, and you take unstretched canvases and work on them on very various methods, right? You dice, you paint. I think you can explain better.
Yeah, my studio practice is very kind of counterproductive. I start with these really large canvases that are placed, propped up on buckets in the studio. And so it starts at a horizontal motion where I'm pouring the paint onto the canvas and manipulating it. I do a lot of tests. I spend days testing color and watching it interact before I go to the canvas. And from there,
They're flat on the floor?
They're flat kind of on top of sawhorses or 5-gallon buckets.
Oh, so that the paint can run through?
They're mostly propped up so that I can reach it with my body.
Mm-hmm.
My work is very physical, though it's not directly figurative. The body is so involved in it. And so I have them propped up so I can easily tilt them from one side to the other. Once the pigment is sitting on the surface, there's
mm-hmm.
kind of this performance that happens where it's about how the movement of the medium interacts and how I can manipulate it with my body as I shift one side of the canvas to the other.
Mm-hmm. Unstretched. So you
No, they're stretched.
Oh, they're stretched already.
Yeah,
okay,
they're all
so
stretched.
You have large canvases stretched and then you work on them, but then you unstretch them again, right?
I do. So then, yeah, there's this constant like act of revealing in my work where I've painted, usually I work with two large canvases in the studio at a time, so I can play with muscle memory and repetition. I'm thinking about how I can create an image and almost copy and paste it with my body going to the other canvas. And from there, I unstretch the canvases and cut them up and rearrange them. And at that point, they're like giant puzzle pieces that I'm placing back together.
And how do you, because I think that you create these very energizing compositions, which sort of on the first glance look painted, and then only if you take a second closer look, you understand they are sewed together, but they still seem to have this motion. These motors are not running against another, they're in flow with another. And I wonder, how do you assemble the different elements? How do you plan that they... It's not a coincidence. You paint and you leave the result, I would say, also to the to the movement.
Yeah.
But then you pick these elements, like these puzzle elements, and put them back together. How do you do that?
So once I've poured the medium onto the canvas and I've pushed the paint around, I'm watching it all day. I'm actually observing the humidity levels in the studio as well.
Yeah.
And slowly but surely the paint is drying and I'm continuing to manipulate it as that's happening. And from there, I unstretch the pieces the next day and begin cutting and rearranging these now giant puzzle pieces, mm-hmm. Or small pieces as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting aspect about this that happens is now I've been cutting and sewing my work for a few years now. What's happening is there's this relationship I'm building with my past self because I'm able to build from stacks of inventory in my studio. So I almost have this library of textures and washes and mark making. So I'm able to pull from the present works that I just painted and also the library that I have stacked in the corner. And I'm combining those pieces and looking for moments of harmony and also clashing.
Okay. So you generate new canvases, which are the sort of starting point or main source, and then you add material from past production, so to speak. So, and then how many different sources from different moods and time periods come together in one canvas?
Well, for this body of work that's in the gallery right now, there's probably about 6 to 7 puzzle pieces that are placed together and sewn, but they really do range in size. And I'm in, and it's not about, okay, I have 7 pieces, I want that to be put together. It could be 2 pieces going together for some shows, and that's just simply enough. But I'm just constantly trying to figure out how I can create these situations of like controlled chaos and rhythm in the paintings.
So it's 7 different sort of sessions which come together in one painting. But is this the case with each of the works here? Or is it sometimes one work consists of 2 or 3 elements?
Yeah, one painting could consist of three elements from a wash I created.
Now it's 7.
Each painting has, let's say, 7 puzzle pieces. Mm-hmm. And one of those paintings could be created from a wash I made. Maybe I'm pulling from different parts of the painting that's cut up and then rearranged. And I think that that's a way I can find ways to make connections across the canvas. You might start to recognize the same wash go from one piece to the next.
And then sometimes they have these like sort of drops on them. They come post the reassembly, or they are also marks from the pre-production, from the first sort of session?
Those happen at the end. So those marks and textures are like palette knife marks or drops of paint, splatters. I view those as like punctuations that happen on the canvas. It's like a means to draw the eye around.
Okay, so this is once the canvas is finished, you add these to it to bring it together somehow.
Exactly.
To create a joint between the, I don't know, like a compositional finish.
Yeah, it's almost like a constellation. It's just a way to draw the eye around and ping from one section of the canvas to the other.
Okay. And as you say, controlled chaos, how much do you control the choice of the elements coming together?
Well, I do that in various ways. Sometimes, like, the piece that is at the beginning of the show called Blue Channel, a lot of that was actually developed digitally. So after I created a few washes, I actually documented it. I photographed it in the studio and then worked with it digitally and rearranged it. And that was a really great way to do it because I was able to look at 50 different options for the same painting mm-hmm. by using the inventory I have and rearranging it. And then from that piece, I did another painting, and it was completely more like analog. And that was because I looked at it digitally and rearranged it. And the physicality of that painting in particular felt like it needed to be handled in person and rearranged to find the composition that worked.
Okay. So, and you say there's a wash means like a batik. Explain wash.
Yeah.
What's a wash?
Yeah, a wash is like a pour on the canvas, and it can be more of an abrupt wash where the paint splatters and is a little bit more chaotic, or it can be something slow where I'm slowly manipulating and lifting it, the canvas, and pouring it from one side to the other.
Okay, so and how many different categories are there, would you say? Like a wash, but do you also have like primed elements or even brush stroke painted elements you sew together? Like how many different source surfaces are there?
It's tricky to say how many because I just work on so many elements in a week, but building a variety of textures and mark making is essentially like building a vocabulary or a library that I'm then able to put together
like constructing a sentence.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. How far back is your library dating?
It goes back to around 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a lot to do with the pandemic.
Yeah.
It felt like I was living in San Francisco at the time, and it felt like pure chaos was happening in the world, and there was a lot of confusion, and it was a huge question of what was going to happen and how we were going to handle this. And so naturally, like many situations in my life, I turn inward and rely on my studio practice. And I was sitting in the studio looking at a few canvases that were leaning against each other, and I was able to see the piece behind the other one. And so it created two images, two different paintings that were created at different times overlapping each other. And one was a much more chaotic painting, and one was a lot soothing and slower.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was drawn to that, and I wanted to figure out ways to fasten that and put that together. I feel like I'm always at odds with figuring out what beauty is in painting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little skeptical if something is too beautiful, but I also think it's a way to draw the eye in and, mm-hmm. and draw the viewer in. It's a great lure. And so with the pandemic hitting, it was March of 2020, I started unstretching all of the canvases in the studio and cutting them up and rearranging them and reworking them. And I don't think I had the intention that I would sew them, but I was trying to figure out how they would be fastened together and what that would look like. And that was when I started teaching myself to sew. And I was breaking a lot of needles and had to upgrade eventually to an industrial sewing machine and get that figured out. But that was kind of the moment where I realized that that was kind of the epiphany of like, this is what controlled chaos is in my work, and this is the balance I want to strike. And from there, I continued just cutting up and rearranging the work.
And when you say you were cutting them up, first, there was, I mean, also an act of destruction, no?
Yeah, and that felt really good. I felt like, I don't know, as a painter, and especially as an abstract painter, there's moments where we fall into this rhythm or even a formula. And as someone that experiments in the studio all the time, I'm also very anti-formula. And so as I started getting more comfortable in the studio, it felt really good to begin questioning the process I had built over the years and cutting it up and destructing it. And it gave me another perspective of looking at it, too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting because it's like a literal self-referencing or sort of self-quoting, going back to earlier work in a literal sense, in incorporating them in new work.
Yeah.
Right? It's like you deal with a... Because every painter, when they paint a painting, they refer to the painting they painted prior to that painting. You know, that what makes Gerd Richter interesting, I think, that he's like, you know, he has these breaks in his work where he's moving from the figurative part then into abstraction, you know, which often has to do with, I don't know, breaks or crisis or things like this. And I find in your work very interesting that you sort of the new work carries the old work in reference in an ongoing flow, which is sort of it with every painting, but here literally with the elements prior made.
Yeah, exactly. I always viewed each piece as kind of like pages in a book, like one piece leads to the next and then goes on to the next painting. And so it was a really great way to combine my past and present self and have those things kind of be at odds with each other.
But you only incorporate or use material you have created.
Right.
You don't take in material from other sources.
I haven't done that yet. I mean, it's abstract, but some of the color and imagery I'm pulling into my work, I'm definitely pulling from the natural world and thinking about sensory perception and memory and thinking about how a sound or a texture or some kind of event can transpire or synthesize into a painted mark or color.
Mm-hmm. So how does nature and the surrounding you live in influences you?
I lived in a lot of major cities, and to describe my living situation now, I live out in the high desert, and I live at the end of a dirt road. It's a washboard, bumpy road, and I don't really have any neighbors, and there's this unsettling feeling at first when you come there. Visitors kind of feel it. They go out there to escape, but I think the desert has this way of revealing itself and holding a mirror up to yourself you're able to kind of confront issues that you've been facing maybe for years. And so living out there, there's no skyscrapers, there's no obstruction of the sky, there's no sounds from the city, no cars or stoplights, at least, you know, around my house.
Mm-hmm.
In the nearest town, of course, there's some of that. But with that, it gave me the emotional and physical space to focus on the paintings. When I was making this body of work, I went for a walk with my dog and my partner, Chase, and it was about 6 a.m., and it was a very still morning. You can even hear wind. And all of a sudden, there was this crow that just leaped off of a boulder and took off into the sky. And it was such a piercing sound, or like a ripple in water. And I think that moments like that really inspire me. And the longer I live out in a place like the desert, I'm more attuned to listening to those things and I'm more sensitive to it. And that has had an impact on my work I'm not sure I could totally unpack today.
What I just thought about is also that painting in general is a very lonely process and very time consuming. Painters are usually alone in the studio for a long period. But what I find interesting with your work is you create the painting and then you are confronted again with your practice when you actually do the work. So because you create it and then you have to, I mean, psychologically, I find it interesting that you have to, so many artists, they don't like retrospectives, you know, because it's a retrospective in a literal sense. And then you have to, you are confronted with your earlier practice and have to live through it again and have to be critical. And so, but you have that in your immanent process that you have to look at the work. So you reference to your earlier work while doing new work. In how's that? Is it because you have to be self-critical too, no?
Yeah. First of all, you're making me realize how vulnerable a retrospective must be. I hadn't thought about it that way. But for these paintings, it's definitely, there's this act of revealing over and over with the pieces. When I start off with these large washes and pullings of pigment, I'm working with that. It's like this performance that only I get to witness in the studio. And then from there, the piece is very wet. It has a very different view from the next morning when I get up and look at it. And I think painting has this incredible way of lifting you up, like the, especially when you might personally need it. And I wouldn't say my work is necessarily just a therapeutic outlet, but there's these moments of gratitude for what I do and every time the piece reveals itself. But it kind of lifts you up, and then it's a very humbling moment when you come back to the studio the next morning, because not all of the washes might turn out, that these fields of pigment might not turn out the way I planned, and that I may end up, you know, wasting a canvas or not being able to use that mm-hmm. piece for something. But it is very vulnerable, and I think that's really great, because the being able to combine two different compositions together, it gives me an opportunity to use like a really gritty moment or a color that is almost dirty in context with a really lush, beautiful movement or texture mark. And when those things are together, they're much stronger than when they were separate.
Yeah. No, but I think that's interesting that your work creates this very energetic power, somehow, which has a strong aura reaching the body, I would say. You know, it has definitely a very strong positive energy. How do you know it has worked out? You have to assemble it completely to judge, or do you know it in the process?
I think it's both. Sometimes I get to the final step of sewing and I've committed all this time via the painted marks, the ones that I created a week ago and the ones I created 3 years ago. I've combined them together and then I sew it and stretch it and I've done all this work and then I flip it around and I don't even, a bad painting sounds too intense, but it's just not the direction I intended. Or I create bodies of work and then I have some outliers that where the painting just doesn't fit in that series. But the outliers are always kind of interesting too. I learned so much, and that goes back to the philosophy of like one piece leads to the next. So, but it also sounds very mature. Like I think there's very frustrating moments in the studio where it didn't turn out and I need to walk away from it and literally go for a walk and recover from losing that piece.
And you never really know also why, no? It just doesn't come together.
Especially with this show, the goal was, how can I think about the sewing machine as also a paintbrush, and how can I paint with something so technical? But I guess with that, I took a lot of risks with this show as far as how far I could push what the sewing machine can do. And so there were pieces where the seams were not doing what they should do, where they were puckering in weird places, and I couldn't save the piece in that way. And the craft is very important because, to me, they're almost sculptural. Like, everything from the construction of them, the way I take apart the canvas and put it back together, and then also the sides of the painting, they're architectural in that way. It wraps around the entire piece.
Mm-hmm. But also, once it's done, it's hard to influence, right? You can't make readjustments.
I can, in that, like, I can unstretch the piece and cut it up again and re-sew other pieces back together.
Okay.
And sometimes those are my best pieces where I've just really pushed it and worked it. But it's a balance because I feel that some of my better paintings balance something more effortless and something more controlled. And in that way, it's like a breath, and the painting doesn't look too challenging.
Yeah. And earlier on, you mentioned printmaking. Maybe you can explore on your approach to printmaking too.
Yeah. Well, I first found my love for it with lithography, working on a stone and carving into it. And I was drawn to, the challenge of it, how fast you could lose an image. And I did that when I was around 16. And then I explored screen printing at Maryland Institute College of Art. And that was where I really discovered some of my strengths as someone that's dyslexic, and the way I could flip an image and use that to my advantage. I think growing up, dyslexia was something that was always this hurdle that I had to work around. And suddenly I thought, wow, this is a strength I can use in my studio practice. But with printmaking, there's overlapping aspects that I'm drawn to, and how I can repeat an image and play with gesture and rhythm. And there's definitely an overlap working on paper and in that process, and also working on canvas in the studio.
But it's a separate practice from your paintings, or how does it come together?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a separate practice, and it's not something I do on my own typically. I've worked with my friend Brad, who has Marginal Editions in Chelsea in New York, and then also with off the grid studio in... actually not far from my studio in the high desert, called Farrington Press.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I'm given the opportunity to collaborate with a printmaker, I just learn so much about different mediums. And so I would say I'm almost drawn more to the experimental aspects of the practice. And then I bring that back to my studio. Like, that when I first started studying the humidity in my studio was when I moved to the desert. And I suddenly realized how fast my paintings were drying. And so I thought, how do I speed this up or slow it down with turning on a humidifier and controlling that a little bit more? And I learned that from printmaking with my friend Kyle at Farrington Press.
Interesting. So the humidity in that area has an influence on the creation of the paintings.
It does. And I mean, I think a lot of artists would agree with that. But I was really concerned about it for the first time when I did a residency in upstate New York called Macedonia Institute. And I was working in the winter, and there was a blizzard outside, and my paintings were taking forever to dry.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of the opposite problem that I have than what I have in the desert. And the humidity in the desert, if I'm lucky, it's up to 20% on a rainy day. And so as I'm trying to figure out how to replicate two images on a canvas in the studio in one day, the humidity is constantly dropping or raising, so the pieces are inevitably going to change. And that's what's interesting about it, too, is as much as I try to control these elements, there's a lot that's out of my hand when I'm working with a very organic medium and the weather is constantly evolving.
Yeah, interesting that the environment has an influence. Like, and which of course, because you mentioned you try to control, how can you control it?
Well, I can control it in that I can turn on a humidifier. That is the more physical way I can do that. Or I can call it a day and make another piece the next day and look at what the humidity is at and continue.
You do it as a way of creating an image?
I do. So the part that I'm not sure I explained very well earlier is just that I'm interested in creating the same image over and over because it's like a chance for me to experiment with muscle memory and repetition. And so doing that, I start with one canvas and create these large washes and pours. And then it's a really great challenge. How can I do that again on the next piece? And inevitably, it's going to shift.
Yeah.
With, you know, my own, you know, with human error, with
and
how I measure.
Gravity changing.
Gravity, yeah.
The Earth is at a different point in that 5 minutes later.
Yeah.
And because of the Earth rotation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, time is such a huge part of my work in the process and the physicality of it, the time of day. And then also just visually looking outside my studio. Actually, this show is called Liminal Spaces in the gallery. And it's really thinking about time in a sense and where we go mentally as we're processing various events in our lives and kind of these corridors we go to mentally. And then also this, what I was touching on earlier, just the desert being this space that people come physically to escape, but end up sitting with a lot of the things going on in their lives.
Yeah. And these two similar paintings you're creating, which are in different results, of course, they reunite later on or they stay separate?
They do.
They do.
Yeah, they reunite. And that kind of goes back to earlier where you were asking about a rhythm happening. And so if I'm able to create the same gesture twice on a piece, I love when I can sew that back together later on from one, you know, the two canvases I started with. They eventually live on the same surface together. And that's how I'm able to play with rhythm. And it kind of reminds me of like when you learn something new and you immediately connect it to something else you know to further understand the concept. And so there's a lot of repeating elements that eventually connect back together on the larger canvas.
Interesting. That's also what a lot of figurative painters do. They do paint the same painting twice and I actually don't really know why, but that you see that also with Hockney and so on. I think because of the, I don't know, exercise or yeah, repetition to see also how the hand behaved on the same sort of brain control signal, but then with a different result. And why two? Or you also do sometimes more than two?
I do more than two sometimes.
Yeah.
But I try to do two to... Sometimes it's just a practicality with the space in my studio, but I have two 90-inch by 64 inches canvases laying out in the studio. And so I'm working at a scale that's much bigger than my body. So it creates the stage for me to work. And one piece I make and then I go to the next. And immediately when you go to the next, of course, you're always comparing the two things together.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned before that you work in series or shows.
Mm-hmm.
How do you separate one series from another?
Well, I mean, a body of work may start with a series of like note-taking or little sketches. I think most of my shows started with that outlier painting where I thought, wow, I made a piece, but this is a bit ahead of me.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't where I'm at in this moment.
Oh, okay.
So then mm-hmm. I'll set that painting aside and then later on the piece makes sense. I just flip it over mm-hmm. and don't look at it for a while. I continue on the trajectory I'm at in a body of work.
And then you come back to the conversation, so to speak, later.
Exactly.
And pick up that word, so to speak.
Yeah, and these paintings are an extension of the work that, I mean, you know, of my whole life, but they're an extension of the work that I sent to Armory that I believe you saw as well.
Yeah.
And, but in the sense... That was when I started experimenting with the shapes that I could sew and how sewing was like another painting medium. And so you see the shapes get a lot more organic in this body of work.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of biomorphic and also resembling nature in that way. There's no straight lines in these paintings.
But it sounds like you're pretty separating one series from another. Like right now you have another show in Paris?
Yes.
What's the difference in the process, for example?
Yeah, so... That body of work, that show is called A Moving Window. And it's almost like, well, first of all, the direct difference is that it's all straight lines in that body of work.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about my relationship standing inside my studio, looking out at the desert.
Yeah.
Looking out at the chaos and these organic shapes flowing and moving. It was more of a study of the sky and color and how it's affected by light. Whereas this body of work, Liminal Spaces, is more about these biomorphic shapes and standing directly in the landscape, putting myself into that chaos and being completely surrounded by it.
Mm-hmm. So the one is more, I would say, introverted, and the other one is more...
extroverted. Yeah, that's a great analogy. It's the other one is just all straight lines, and I'm in the architecture, and you kind of feel the architecture of the painting.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this body of work here, there are no straight lines.
But you're not working plein air, right? You work in sort of a little plein air-like-ish because you are alone in the middle of the desert looking out, but you're not working outside, right?
Right. Yeah, I'm not working outside. That would make it difficult with the scale that I'm working at, and also just... imagine the work would evaporate even faster and it would be hard to move the pigment and medium and water around the canvas.
Yeah, because you use a lot of water on running through the canvas, huh?
Yeah, and other types of medium, and that flow in the beginning of the process is really important to the work. And it's a great way for me to immediately lose control.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more medium or water that's added to the surface, the more... challenges it creates. It kind of reminds me, Philip Guston once said that a painting has to go on trial to defend itself. And mm-hmm. if it hasn't done that, one can be a little bit skeptical. And I think that if I were to begin painting directly with a paintbrush, I would have a little bit too much control. And so I'm constantly trying to think about ways to create obstacles, whether it's a lot of medium at once onto the canvas. Maybe the canvas is propped up on one angle and there's an immediate slope that happens. Or I'm using a paintbrush, but it's extremely long and wide and difficult to control.
Mm-hmm. And how much time do you take between you finish these dual canvases before they come together in sewing on a stretcher?
Well, that varies. So I think in the beginning, I'm thinking about a series as a whole. There's a slowness at first where I'm experimenting with the color, and I have stacks and stacks of test marks in the studio where it's just looking at how color interacts with each other, and that will help me develop the body of work. But then from there, it speeds up just a little bit in that I start working on washes, and I may do two pours on the canvas in one day, and then the next day I'm already unstretching it and cutting and rearranging just to kind of get in there and work in an analog way.
It's drying so fast, yeah?
Yeah, it dries very fast
overnight,
by the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then that gives me an understanding, and I learn something new every time, especially as I'm exploring a new body of work. And I might, if something catches my eye, I might begin sewing right away. And that I can even work till 4 a.m. sometimes as I get into the flow.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll stretch the piece the next morning. And so that could happen in a matter of a few days. But then as I get further into a body of work, things really slow down because time sitting with the work is really crucial. It's kind of what I was talking about with this feeling of a painting can feel amazing one evening. And I'm like, this is it. I'm incredible.
Is gone.
Yeah.
And next day is like a foreigner.
It's just the most humbling moment when I come back in the studio and I think, what have I done and what was I thinking?
Yeah.
Pieces create, I have these kind of conversations in my head with these paintings and it evolves over time. So the more time I have with a piece, the more I learn and it takes me to the next painting. So that's why the longer time I have with the painting, even after it's done, I like to have extra time before it ships out of the studio.
Now you arrived here, the show is hung. When you meet the paintings again, your relationship is in balance, or you sometimes think I should have done something different here or there?
I think I'm still processing it, but I feel good about this show. I don't know. It's refreshing to see it out of the studio because by the time a body of work ships, the studio is just so crowded and all of the pieces become one and blended. And so even as I get further into working on a show, I have to start flipping things over and putting them away so that my mind can rest a little bit.
Yeah,
So if anything, I think they look a little better seeing them with the white walls and the room for them to breathe.
Because I heard often from painters when they do a show and they loan works from the past, that they have really hold back to not rework the work, because there are things they want to change, but of course it's not their painting anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I think perspective can be really challenging and vulnerable at times. And so ask me what I think about this body of work in about a year, and I could feel very differently about it.
What I think is interesting is that you are there in Joshua Tree, sort of you and your partner pretty much alone, but at the same time, or not alone, but like connected to nature and like, as we can hear now, very sensitive to small details surrounding you. But at the same time, you're like connected, and that's a new reality we didn't have, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago. You're connected to a lot of people and you share on your social media channel your practice. How does that go together?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess I should also add that there's this incredible community in the desert, especially a community of artists and all types of creatives that really surprised me as we embedded ourselves there and learned and met so many people in the area. But yeah, the other aspect of that, there's social media, and it's a wonderful tool for building community and meeting artists and gallerists like yourself. But it was kind of, it's kind of a daunting thing too. I think I graduated from Maryland Institute College of Art. I studied painting and art history there and moved from Baltimore to San Francisco. And I was just trying to figure out how to make my studio practice work while I also had a day job at the time. There was just kind of a turning point as I was sharing some aspects of my studio practice where it snowballed in ways that I don't think I could understand then, but it's...
Oh, in the pandemic, when you mentioned that you start to take off the canvases and cut them, this is when it...
No, this was probably back in like 2014 or so.
Okay.
When I was fresh out of art school and trying to find my voice as an artist and figure out what that looks like. And also finding my people, finding a new arts community, being in a new city. And so I took to social media to share some aspects of my studio practice. And there was a point where it kind of snowballed and was a little intimidating. I definitely sometimes struggle with like public speaking or being on any kind of platform. And so it was weird as I started to develop more followers on Instagram. And
Because you were, of course, in the early days, so to speak, in San Francisco, where it's coming from, and there, of course, from there, the community grew, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think snowballing is probably the best way to describe it, but I would get a lot of followers all at once or in various weeks and not totally understand where they were coming from. But it was a beautiful thing in that it connected me with a great community of artists online. And coming out of art school, you have that built-in community. And so moving to California and not knowing anyone, I thought, like, how am I going to continue to connect with people, both physically in person, visiting artist studios and galleries, but also on the internet. Mm-hmm. And San Francisco, you know, it's kind of this strange feeling when I first moved there, especially around 2013, 2014. It felt a little bit like I had moved to the internet,
totally,
especially then in those kind of startup days of San Francisco. But it's a really great, social media is a great tool to use and a vehicle to build community, but it's definitely a time consuming thing. And I found it helpful to get on and share what I'm working on and interact with artists, and get off. And my favorite thing about it is that the amount of artists I've met on the platform is really incredible. And no matter what city I'm in, I can usually reach out to an artist and we can have a studio visit or grab a coffee and talk in person.
When did you move out from San Francisco to Joshua Tree?
It's a little blurry because me and my partner, Chase, actually, we built our house in Joshua Tree. It's a house and studio. And we started construction a little bit before the pandemic. And then when the pandemic hit, we moved out to the desert to rent a house and oversee construction as it was slowing down due to various reasons from the pandemic. And so we felt like we needed to be there. So I actually held on to my studio in San Francisco, depending on when I needed to be there and produce some of the paintings. So it's kind of blurry, but I guess we left around 2022.
Ah, interesting. Always planned as a permanent residence and mainstay, yeah? That's a big move, no?
Oh, yeah. It was a very naive decision, if I'm being honest, but incredibly worth it and fulfilling. Construction was stressful and intense because me and my partner were funding it ourselves, of course, but I think that naivete is what helped us propel us forward and with that decision. And it was an interesting moment when we're moving officially to the desert. And I thought, wow, we're really doing this. My partner Chase was like, are you serious? We just spent all this time on construction. But it was just a daunting moment and that we had been anticipating for so long that I had to adjust to. But that was when we really leaned in on this idea of community that at times it felt challenging to do that in a place like San Francisco. And my partner is actually, he volunteers on the Community Association board there.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have several artist friends now. And it really just involved us showing up in the community, going to events and getting to know people on a more personal level than I felt I was able to do in some major cities I've lived in.
Interesting. Yeah, this naivety created that space. My wife and I just started to renovate this church and probably, thank God, without reflecting what it potentially could mean, because we always almost got broke over creating it. But then sometimes it's good to be not too sort of self-critical and just do it, no?
Yeah, that was a very ambitious project for sure.
Yeah, and tell me because you mentioned your mother was a Marine, and so she was assigned to different locations. How was that growing up in such a context?
She was. She was a Marine, and so we moved a lot. And I don't know, I kind of thrived under moving and putting myself in new situations, and I think it's helped me a lot as an adult. If anything, moving to the desert was a really great way to take a moment to get to know myself in another way and not pick up and move every 2 years, because mm-hmm. I had moved about 18 times by the time I was graduating high school.
Wow. And that's all over the planet.
Yeah,
you mentioned Japan and...
I mean, mostly the U.S., but I was in Japan when I was very little.
Yeah.
And Hawaii. Yeah.
Wow. So it's sort of a counterpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if there must be a way that my paintings kind of reflect that, thinking about physical maps and geography and also mind maps and how we
mm-hmm.
travel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But also influences, you think? Maybe subconscious, no?
I think so, yeah. That would be probably hard to unpack, but definitely.
Yeah, but the reference with the time or the map is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they're almost like shifted landscapes coming together, no? Yeah.
Yeah, and my work, I think it kind of comes and goes, but you see various landscapes, and it's, even though I've lived in a lot of cities, I was always kind of drawn to the natural world, mm-hmm. and living in San Francisco, especially, like, you're surrounded by water. You have the bay, and then you have the ocean right there. And that, like, movement and tension with the land and water was something that was relevant in my work as soon as I moved there. That push and pull is always relevant in my work, whether it's more literal landscape or more abstract.
Yeah. You know that the bricks your work is hanging on now, at least, I mean, there's one white wall, but the other bricks... they are the bricks from the buildings which were standing around here, which were bombed in the Second World War. And then the architect reassembled, he collected all these bricks where the Trümmerfrauen, famous Trümmerfrauen, were like collecting it. And then they were emptied of the cement and then built. So the church was rebuilt based on these bricks.
Wow, that's really cool. I didn't know that. And all the bricks were in the area?
They're all the bricks, because it's this whole area here was called Zeitungsviertel. And because there was a Mehringplatz, which is a circular place, of course, there was no GPS then. And the bomber pilots were instructed to drop all bombs once reached that plaza and come back. And so there was not really a strategic reason here, because there were only newspapers and... So there were no arm factory or political headquarters or something like this. It was just because the length of the plane, apparently that's what I read in a history book, was about to end. So they were supposed to come back. And then they just dropped all the bombs here. So the neighborhood here is complete. There was, you see, when you arrive from the Gitschinerstraße, walk to the gallery, there are like 3-4 older houses. And then everything is a new build, 50s architecture. Because the whole neighborhood was flat, and then the architect to sort of build a bridge, conceptual bridge, I think, to the pre-war times. He collected all these stones and resurrected the church from these. So it's like a collage from the former stones from the houses.
Wow, that's great. Also that the architect was able to create that transition from the old and the new.
Yeah, like a hope, no? Yeah. And that's interesting also with the church appears almost like a bunker. And only when you're inside, the soft light is coming from the top and you feel more like in a womb, you know? It's more like, I don't know, protecting shelter.
Yeah,
but from outside, it's very rough and it has these like extreme stucco surface where you can really hurt yourself when you touch it, you know?
Yeah, that is true. There is kind of a harsh, extreme
outside
facade. Yeah,
and
brutalist.
Inside it's soft light. And I think also it goes very well with how your works is lit now, you know, with the daylight.
Heather, thanks so much for taking us to Joshua Tree and at least the idea of your studio practice there. Thank you for this beautiful exhibition and great conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.